Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy solstice. I'm Diane Lees. So the big news this week is about Austrian ultra-distance rider Christoph Strasser, who broke the under 8-day barrier as well as a long-standing speed barrier and won Ram 2013. He never wavered in his determination, said right at the outset that he wouldn't be satisfied with less than breaking the record. Our own Cassie Schumacher is still in the race. Hopefully we'll make it over the Appalachians without a hitch, a mighty feat. I have to say, we are really proud of you, Cassie. There's an update about the alleged wage and benefit dispute between Alta Bike Share and the Washington, D.C. bike share workers. Here is what Hannah Kane from the D.C. Employment Justice Center had to say on Thursday. Wednesday morning, past and present Capital Bike Share workers joined with community supporters to deliver their petition to Capital Bike Share management. Their demand that Bike Share's parent company, Alta, comes into compliance with their federal contract and the Service Contract Act by no later than July 3rd. The petition launched on coworker.org in late May has gathered nearly 1,500 signatures. The petition was also accompanied by a letter to Alta President Mia Burke, signed onto by 23 past and present workers. When Capital Bike Share Director Eric Gilliland emerged from the bike share warehouse in Southwest D.C., he encountered a group of bike share workers accompanied by community supporters from the EJC, D.C. Jobs with Justice, Our DC, and International Workers of the World. The workers presented Mr. Gilliland with the petition and asked for him to take action. Following a press conference, the bike share workers also delivered their petition to the DC Department of Transportation. DDOT has had a contract with Alta since 2010, and it remains unclear as to whether DDOT was aware that Alta was not complying with wage and benefit requirements in the contract and why they did not take action. So that was Hannah Kane's commentary after they delivered that petition. I once again tried at least three different times in three different ways to contact Alta Bike Share for comment without success. I was really hoping to get a hold of somebody so that they could give us their side of the story. On the woohoo front, looks like public opinion won out as Pat McQuaid failed to get the nomination for re-election as president of the UCI from either Ireland or Switzerland. So we'll definitely keep an eye open for that. There's a lot of other news that I hope to cover a bit later in the show. But now I'd like to tell you about tonight's show itself and our guests. One of the best books I reviewed and used in the past year has been Chef Bijou Thomas's Feed Zone Cookbook. When I was given an opportunity a little while ago to get a copy of his new book, Feed Zone Portables, I said, heck yeah. So Chef Bijou has been doing a lot of traveling. He's been on the road most of this year, cooking for the Pro Peloton, as well as developing new recipes and ideas for this new book. He and his working partner, Dr. Alan Lim, have also finally released their secret formula electrolyte drinks under the Scratch Labs name. And Bijou is part of a very interesting and useful project called IceDot, ICEDOT.org. Very interesting. He's a busy guy, but I snagged him for an interview this evening and we'll find out about yummy foods for on the go, riding, running, and racing, as well as just some cool and simple ideas to try at home. Chef Bijou will be my guest in the second half of the show. Rob Vanderplas is an author. And he's been authoring books for as long as I've been in the bike business. But Rob is a professional mechanical engineer and has been immersed his entire life in bicycles and bicycle-related projects. His newest book is especially delicious, and it has nothing to do with food. Ray Boer, The Bicycle Illustrations of Daniel Ray Boer, is one of those books you would pick up again and again and again. Ray Boer was a technical illustrator whose career was largely spent documenting bicycles and bicycle components in a unique pen and ink style. It is instantly recognizable to anyone who has ever seen one of his drawings. We'll find out what prompted Rob to publish the book, as well as how he came to know all the information that accompanies the illustrations in text and captions. So after I speak with Rob, we'll get to this week's news and then a break. Let's not tarry. Grab your favorite beverage, settle back, and let's welcome Rob Vanderplas to The Outspoken Cyclist. Rob, thank you for joining me this evening.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Your new book is a coffee table, fully illustrated book about Daniel, is it Rabour?
The correct pronunciation is Daniel Rabour.
Daniel Rabour.
Very nice.
Oh, thank you so much. I am not a linguist, but I appreciate you moving me along with it. So tell us who Daniel Rabour was and give us a bit of history about his work.
Daniel Rabour is probably the most prolific illustrator of the bicycle. His work appeared in French trade magazines and other bicycle publications ever since the Second World War until the late 1970s. He used a drawing technique that is quite unique to him. They're line drawings, and someone in the book, which I'm not going to reveal here, explains how he achieved this incredible clarity. Before the war, the Second World War, he had worked for a motorcycle magazine called Motor Revue, a French motorcycle magazine, and he worked as both a test rider and an illustrator for the publication. His education had been in illustration. During the war, he worked for a motor part components manufacturer as illustrator for their catalog, illustrator and designer for their catalogs. And after the war, he was approached by one of his friends, André Gesselin, to join him in a newly published magazine called Le Cycle, the bicycle. It is a trade magazine, but it didn't only deal with the commercial aspects of the job, but also the technical aspects of the bicycle. And Rabour inserted himself in that magazine in more ways than just as illustrator. He tested many components, wrote about them, had a remarkable clarity of explanation in how things worked and why certain things wouldn't work. So his illustrations were often complemented with his text. This lasted until the 1970s, when the bicycle trade really had gone down pretty severely in most of Europe. The magazine was no longer published. After that period, he worked mainly illustrating manufacturers' catalogs. The French tool company VAR, V-A-R,
right,
which you may be familiar with, used his illustrations, and Shimano used his illustrations in their French catalogs.
Well, his style is unmistakable. I mean, the moment you see a drawing that Rabour did, you can see that it is his work. You know, in your introduction, you talk about the difference among the people who actually rode bicycles at the time between the wars, First and Second World War. And I found it interesting that those who wanted and would pay for better componentry were the independent professionals, artisans, and owners of small to medium-sized businesses, as you say. And that out of that clientele, derailleur gearing systems and sophisticated brake systems became accepted by the racers. So it wasn't the competitive racers who drove the technology as much as the touring, randonneuring, long-distance riders, it seems.
Certainly in those days, that was the case. During much of this period, the Tour de France organizers, for instance, insisted that the racers used certain bicycle designs, and the use of derailleur gearing was actually outlawed on Tour de France bikes for a long period.
Huh.
Whereas the tourist had no such restrictions.
Right.
Now, we also have to remember that racers in Europe, during this period certainly, and cyclists in general in Europe during this period were entirely different animals and were very different from American cyclists. For Americans, cyclists were children. during this period. Adults didn't ride bicycles.
Good point.
In France, which was much less motorized, even though the many of the first motor cars were actually French, places, manufacturers like Peugeot predated Ford by many years, France was not motorized until really the late 1960s. So we had different kind of people. The racers were by and large working class men doing a job. The somewhat more affluent people, they would have been people like teachers, lawyers, doctors, had the money to experiment with their bicycles. It was their hobby as well as their sport. And since the roads were not terribly crowded, it was quite pleasant to go bicycle touring. So we have these different kinds of people. Well, these more educated people were obviously more interested in fine-tuning things. And that's really the background of this difference between developments in racing and developments in tourism.
Interesting, because, you know, randonneuring is growing again. The long distance, the Paris-Brest-Paris, those races are getting bigger again.
Right.
And, you know, I know that the UCI, for example, still puts some interesting restrictions on certain things in bicycles, but certainly not, I don't think, on componentry. And componentry is very different today. So
yeah.
So the book, which, again, is it's Rebord, the Bicycle Illustrations of Daniel Rebord. The table of contents is huge.
And there are quite a few bits.
There are. Well, there are over 2,000 illustrations in the book. How did you organize it? How did you decide to organize it the way you did? Because it's very easy to navigate the book.
I'm glad it turned out to be easy. I broke the book's contents down two ways. In the first place, I wanted full-size bicycles throughout the book. So on most pages, the bottom part of the page is devoted to full bicycle drawings, going chronologically from the earliest to the most recent, and we've got about 200 of those. Then the upper part of the page and some whole pages are devoted to individual component categories. So I have one chapter that's all the frame details, another chapter that's devoted to derailleur gearing, and again, these go largely chronologically through the chapters. And towards the end of the book, we leave the individual components. We've got a chapter on accessories. There's a chapter on tandem bicycles. Oddly enough, tandems recently have become more popular, certainly in the United States. Then we have a chapter on folding and parting bikes, children's bikes. But then we go into more odd things that most people don't think of when they think of Rebord. Suspension systems. Well, obviously, since the development of the mountain bike, suspension systems have become more prominent. But we've got some drawings from the 1940s that show interesting suspension details. They have stuff like trailers and sidecars, and an interesting chapter called Alternative Drives. And often people have thought of what I thought were clever ways of propelling a bicycle that aren't a conventional way, rather than cranks, chain, sprockets. They would put in a ratchet device, or they want to drive both the front and the rear wheel, or they want to use both their hands and their legs, and that kind of thing. So these are basically curiosities, but Rebord did some fine drawings of them. In his text, he would explain why they didn't work in most cases.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners. We're speaking with Rob Vanderplas. He is an author and has just assembled this amazing book on Daniel Rebord, The Bicycle Illustrations of Daniel Rebord. He is a beautiful illustrator from probably early cycling. I'd say like the 40s through the 70s. Is that what you said? Somewhere
correct
in there? Yeah. It's just an awesome book. I really like it. Did you find anything that you didn't expect as you were researching and assembling the book?
To be quite honest, I did not, because I have been familiar with the man's work so long that just about every drawing he's ever done I had seen before. I can show people things that they didn't expect.
Probably. I've seen things in there I didn't expect.
No. when I showed somebody the book, the first thing he said, what? 1948? That was a CO2 cartridge for inflating tires. Well, yeah, they were in use in 1948.
Interesting, interesting. Why do you think that the French components, like the strong lights, like the Simplex, like the Urez, disappeared? Yep, you got it.
Yes.
What happened?
The 1970s were a point where France was motorized and the idea of the bicycle changed. In America, which suddenly turned into a huge market for bicycles, adults all of a sudden discovered that they could ride a bicycle. That's the period of what we refer to as the 10-speed boom. Vast numbers of bicycle components were needed, and they needed to be mass manufactured, and they needed to be cheap, because at that time, the 10-speed bicycle was a $100 item. And the French didn't understand the sudden impulse of Americans to start riding a kind of bicycle they'd never ridden before. And although they had the components, they didn't understand the market. Whereas the Japanese caught on very quickly. There's Shimano, Suntour, but there are various other ones like Sakaringo, Ringo, and a couple of other Japanese manufacturers really had their finger on the pulse of the market, whereas the French thought either this is a flash in the pan and it will go away again. These people, we've always been happy with our components. Why don't they just install our components? Well, main problem was they didn't have the capacity and they didn't expand the capacity because they believed it was a flash in the pan.
That is the best explanation I have ever heard of that phenomenon.
I think it's closest to it, yes.
It probably is. So were you able to actually discern anything about the artist himself, about Daniel Rebord, from his work and your research?
Yeah. He was a very private person. I have met him twice at trade shows in, one of those in Paris, and I think the other one was in Milan, in the early 1980s. Very private person, but friendly enough. Like when I asked him, can I use any of your drawings? He said, oh, yeah, go ahead. As long as you leave my name on it, that's not the problem. So he was first jovial and friendly to people, but very few people know anything about him. I have somebody in France, a lawyer, trying to find what happened after he died. Nobody's been able to trace anything. We don't know. We know he was married. We know he had an elder brother who died a couple of years later. His wife died about 8 years after he had died himself in 1991. I've had people interviewing them. Very few can tell you anything about his private life.
And he had no children?
He appears not to have had any children.
Interesting.
As I say, I have a lawyer looking for his offspring so that I can be sure that everything is authorized. And after a year's work, she hasn't found an offspring. So,
wow.
And there's no record of him having a child. I just wanted to make sure that it's actually true.
Sure, sure. So why do you think, Rob, his work is so important and you've sort of memorialized it in this wonderful book?
Because I don't want it to be forgotten. It shows a period in much better detail than photographs do. It shows items that continue to be inspiration for designers. A number of books that I've sold of this have gone to people who are bicycle designers. People in mainly in Japan, by the way.
Interesting.
They want to get their hands on it and see which other directions than what they're familiar with they may go. And although the book claims to have 2,000 illustrations, many of these illustrations actually contain 6, 5, sometimes 10 individual illustrations. So if you count every picture, there are probably more like 5,000 of them.
Wow.
Often, it's just going over the book for the third or the fourth or the fifth time that you see something, oh, wow, this is interesting, I have missed that before. It's inspiration more than anything else. Also, it's just a delight to look at the quality of the illustrations.
How can somebody get a copy of the book besides me? And I'm so lucky. I got a review copy, which I so appreciate.
Well, in the first place, of course, we have our own website, but any bookshop can order the book.
Okay.
It is also available on Amazon.
So,
my website,
yes,
which is my company's website, is cyclepublishing, spelled as one word, .com. The book is available on there.
The book is lovely, and it would make a great addition to anybody's library of cycling books. It is a beautiful coffee table book, Rabor, The Bicycle Illustrations of Daniel Rabor by Rob Vanderplas and Frank Berto. Rob, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and you're right. This is going to be a lifetime of reading this book. You can pick it up, and every time you pick it up, you're going to see something different.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed talking to you.
Have a great afternoon.
You too.
Alrighty,
bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Rob Vanderplas joined me from his offices in the Bay Area of California. The book is really lovely. I'm very proud to have a copy. It is sitting on the coffee table at home, actually. So it really is interesting. If you like that kind of technical stuff, you'll like this. So I'm going to bring you the news, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll bring in Chef Bijou Thomas. But there have been a couple of not-so-pleasant news items this week. And the first one is one of those just incredibly unfortunate circumstances. The article is from BDN staff writer Nok Noy Ricker in Bangor, Maine. Bicyclist in trek across Maine was drinking water at time of fatal collision with Canadian truck, police say. So from Augusta, Maine, a bicyclist who died last Friday while participating in the trek across Maine lost control of his bike while drinking from a water bottle as a tractor trailer passed him, according to police. David LeClaire, 23, of Watertown, Mass., hit his head in the fall from his bike, and he was partially run over by the big rig, investigators said. The incident occurred on U.S. Route 2 in the Oxford County town of Hanover. Quote, based on witness statements, LeClaire was sipping water from a water bottle at the time of the crash, Lieutenant Walter Greisib, commander of Maine State Police Troop B, which covers Hanover, said Monday. Witnesses said when the truck went past, LeClaire lost control of his bike and fell into the path of the truck. LeClaire was pedaling with half a dozen of his Athena Health cycling teammates when the group was passed about 8:45 a.m. Friday by Michel Mas de Fresne, 24, of Quebec, who was carrying corn to Augusta for Transport Beauregard, Inc., also of Quebec. Videos collected from a Rumford business and a responding police cruiser and descriptions by eyewitnesses linked the big rig to the fatality. Massé de Fresne was stopped by police a short time later in Rumford, about 6 miles from the scene. The truck driver said he, quote, passed hundreds of bikes and did not notice anything. Stephen McCausland, spokesman for the Department of Public Safety, said Saturday, there is little likelihood any charges will be lodged against the trucker, but the final crash report will be reviewed by the Oxford County District Attorney's Office once it is completed sometime in the next month or so, McCausland stated in a press release issued Monday. The trek across Maine is a 3-day, 180-mile bicycle ride that raises funds for the American Lung Association. It started at Sunday River Ski Resort in Newry and ended in Belfast. More than 2,000 cyclists participated. LeClaire graduated magna cum laude from Bentley University of Waltham, Mass. In 2011, and he started working for Athena Health the same year. Around 130 of his fellow Athena team members wore red ribbons tied around their arms in his memory as they crossed the finish line on Sunday. So following sad with sad, on Tuesday, a freakish accident at the San Diego Velodrome has resulted in the death of rider Jackie Dunn Price. She only began racing last year, quickly moved up to Cat 3. Then about a month ago, she decided to try track racing. Wednesday night, she got tangled with another rider at the top of the track, fell, and hit the back of her head. She passed away early Thursday. There was a memorial ride this morning, Saturday, that traversed her favorite route in San Diego. There is a fund set up to help offset some of the family's unexpected expenses For more information, you can go to GoFundMe.com/3BRXTW. There is a link on the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. Both of these stories are very sad, but what is heartening is how the cycling community goes to such great lengths to honor their fallen and their families. So that was a really sad one, and I actually found out about it and all the details from a really good friend of mine who lives in San Diego, and her coach was the first responder on the scene for Jackie. Unfortunate, unfortunate. So this is kind of a happy bipartisan announcement that came this week. It even includes Congressman David Joyce, who's the Republican from Ohio, and Congresswoman Doris Matsui, whom we've discussed before. She is the Democrat from California. They introduced the Safe Streets Act of 2013 into the House of Representatives. The measure would ensure safer streets for all Americans, including people of all ages and abilities who are walking, bicycling, driving, or taking public transportation. Quote, "Too many of the roads in our country are designed solely with drivers in mind," said Congresswoman Matsui. "The risks of such design are evident in the number of pedestrian bicycle deaths and injuries we see every year and often discourage more people from considering other transportation methods. That's why I am pleased to introduce the Safe Streets Act of 2013, bipartisan legislation that would ensure our community streets are developed with all users in mind. Complete streets policies have been a major success at the local and state level, saving lives, easing congestion, fighting air pollution, and creating forward-looking projects that provide lasting value. I look forward to working with Representative Joyce and my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to ensure our streets are safe for all users, regardless of their age, mobility, or mode of travel." I often wonder why this bill needs to be reintroduced every single year. So it's the Complete Streets Act of 2011, 12, now it's 13. Maybe it's different, but I'd like to see it enacted and stay in place with only minor tweaks when they need them. Okay, I have to admit, I get sometimes sucked into watching silly and funny videos, but this week I saw an awesome bike video that if you love Rube Goldberg type things and bikes, it's worth 4 minutes and 16 seconds of your time. It's from grist.org, posted by Sarah Laskow. And the title is "Awesome Bike Parking System Sucks Your Ride Into the Depths of the Earth." Bikes are great and all, but as more people start cycling instead of driving, it doesn't necessarily make sense to create new slabs of empty asphalt on which to park bikes. A better solution is Japan's EcoCycle Anti-Seismic Underground Bicycle Park. Instead of paging large swaths of the ground, it stores your ride vertically underneath it. The bicycle park is just about 23 feet wide, and Habitat says, but it can hold 144 bikes on a magic underground spiral, and it works automatically. Watch it in action as the bikes are sucked into these machines and drawn deep into the depths of the earth. The key action is around 1 minute 30 seconds. Also, it's much, much harder for anyone to steal your bike when it's secure underground, although we're still hoping for a James Bond chase scene in the bike storage space. So it is fascinating. You wheel the bike up to this little door. You put it your card in. The door opens. Your bike is wheeled onto this rail, and it gets spiraled down into an empty slot. It was just awesome watching it. It's grist.org, and I'm sure all you have to do is put Japan Underground Bike Parking System into your browser, and you'll probably find it. So this is a feel-good story, finally. And this is from the blog Biking in L.A. Breaking news. Pacific Coast Highway cyclists saved two scuba divers from drowning off of the Malibu coast. Thousands of drivers speed by every day, but it took a couple of cyclists to hear the cries for help and save a pair of scuba divers trapped in the unforgiving surf. Bankruptcy attorney and cyclist Stanley E. Goldich reports that he was on his way back from a ride up PCH on Saturday when he passed a group of riders stopped on the ocean side of the highway near Deer Creek Road. He saw a number of bicycles on the side of the road, looking like the riders had gone down to the beach, as well as a couple of cyclists with their riding cleats off. While it caught his attention, it didn't seem like anything was wrong, so he continued riding. But when a fire truck roared up and stopped at that exact spot, he turned around to check things out, and what he found surprised him. He spoke with two women, Martha Hunt and Rachel Hosmer, both triathletes who were on the backside of a ride from Santa Monica to The Rock. As they rode, they heard yells for help that seemed to come from the ocean. And when they stopped, they discovered two men in scuba suits trapped in the surf and unable to climb out due to the steep slope of the shore. Their wetsuits had filled with water, and they were drowning as they were being dragged down by the undertow and excess weight. Hunt immediately threw off her bike shoes and made her way down the steep embankment, first pulling out the man closest to her, then going back out to the man further from the shore who seemed to be in greater difficulty. He proved to be more than she could handle on her own, but fortunately Hosmer flagged down another group of passing cyclists, five of whom went into the water to help Hunt pull the drowning man to safety. Goldich reports that the men were still being treated by firefighters when he left. They were conscious, although clearly in need of medical attention, but should be okay. They reportedly told Hunt that they were training for their scuba certification. This was only their second time using the equipment. Thankfully, it may not be their last. Cyclists may be far from the most popular people in Malibu these days, but I have a feeling that two men and their families are very grateful that Hunt and Hosmer went out for a Saturday ride on the PCH. The two men tonight are breathing, who might be without him had it not been for these two women. So that was my feel-good story, and I think it's awesome. Cyclists do help other people. I think it happens all the time. Somebody actually caught this one, as we say, on tape. So that's the news. I'm going to take a short break, and I'll be back to talk with Chef Bijou Thomas on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
From June 21st through June 23rd, Tri-State American Saddle Horse Breeders Futurity presents the Pink Ribbon Classic Charity Horse Show at Sunbow Valley Farm in Ravenna. All proceeds from this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday All Breeds Horses and Pony Show will benefit breast cancer charities. Admission is free and vendors will be on hand. Event schedules and more by calling 412-298-2512 or email amy@royalfarms.com.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees. Let's head on out to Boulder, Colorado and catch up with Chef Bijou Thomas and talk about his new book, Feed Zone Portables. Chef Bijou, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, great, Diane. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure because I have a new cookbook, which I'm really excited to talk about. And since we talked about your last one, Feed Zone Cookbook, you've done a lot of stuff, work with a lot of folks, and you seem to be on the road constantly.
Yeah, I pretty much seem to be living on the road.
Well, so what's going on?
Well, just the way that it goes, between all the training camps and the riders and the all the other stuff happening, I'm usually right now gone at least 2 weeks. And it's funny, it's like I was gone from January until pretty much a week ago. I was gone the entire time. So now I'm home for about a week and a half. But there seems to always be something happening. And, you know, we only book anymore the stuff where we can actually show up and be lively and alert. Because if I wanted to just book stuff wall to wall, we could, but then I'd be comatose most of the time.
And then how could you test new recipes?
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What I've been doing since I've been getting up at like 5:30 and trying all sorts of random food.
And I want to talk about that because the fact that you test your food before you actually serve it to the athletes is interesting to know how you do that and what you do. But let's talk a little bit about Scratch Labs, what it is and what that does, and then Feed Zone Portables, which is your new book, and which I'm finding very interesting. There are a lot of recipes in there that really look good, not just for athletes on the road, but for people like me who are always on the go. So
Absolutely. Tell
me about Scratch Labs, and then let's talk about the book.
Yeah, that's a good one. Scratch Labs is an all-natural exercise hydration product. So it's a drink mix. It's a dry powder drink mix that you put into your bottle when you're exercising. And then we also have a product that is something that you drink when you're not exercising, but you're feeling either dehydrated or sick or after like really big efforts and you need to kind of restore your electrolyte levels. So those are the two products that Scratch Labs make. And
The company was started originally by Dr. Alan Lim. He was the sports sciences director at the Garmin cycling team. And, you know, started developing the product then, and then after he left, we used to make it in Alan's living room. We'd mix up batches of it, take it to the local hardware store in these big paint buckets, have it mixed up. And it used to be called Secret Trick Mix, and it was just sold in little silver packets.
I remember that.
Yeah, that's what it was.
And, the
secret drink.
Secret drink
mix, because a lot of the athletes we worked with at the time, they all had, you know, sponsors and other commitments, but they were using our products. So they would put this in the bottle, and you know, nobody ever really was allowed to talk about it, so we just kept it as a secret. And that went on for a couple of years, and then we realized more and more people wanted it, and there was a lot of demand for it. So in February of 2012, so a little over a year and a half ago, we launched what is now called Scratch Labs, just so we could actually sell it openly as a branded product. But the principle itself is it's very minimal ingredients. It's got more electrolytes than most of the products on the market. The flavor and color and anything in it comes from just freeze-dried fruit. So the actual flavor that you're getting is freeze-dried fruit juice from lemons, from limes, from pineapples, from raspberries, from oranges, and any color you see in the drink mix also is just purely a side benefit of having real fruit in there.
Huh.
And yeah, we use real cane sugar. So the whole thing was keep it really simple, keep it ingredients that your body actually understands and can absorb, and keep the balance of carbohydrates to electrolytes and flavor and everything, stuff that you can actually drink without making yourself sick. And the bigger component is a lot of exercise drinks and a lot of products work. If you're only going out for an hour or so, you don't really notice a big deal. But after 2 hours, after 3 hours, you know, can you still keep drinking and can you still keep eating? And that's usually the big variance.
Aha. Uh-huh. So Alan, evidently being the person who does this kind of developing, figured out that what happens in the body needs a different balance of electrolytes than, say, some of the other products on the market, because evidently yours works well. And by the way, I haven't tried it, and I really should. I know I have customers who use it and who order it, so
yep.
And they love it. And one is training for a marathon, so I am assuming that is going to work really well for him. So tell me what's in that Scratch Labs kitchen trailer. And you say it's not a kitchen trailer. You're not cool enough for a van. So what is that beautiful Scratch Labs thing?
No, it actually isn't what I think, because I think you'd ask you know, what's in our van. I'm like, wow, that makes it sound really cool.
It is cool.
Ours is an actual trailer. Our food is all trailer made. So it's an actual commercial kitchen that's in a 20-foot trailer. You go inside there, and for anybody who's worked in a restaurant kitchen, it's very familiar. You go in there, there's a big, you know, it's all stainless steel surfaces. There's a huge oven in there. There's we keep a deep fryer in there just in the middle of winter when we're doing cross season stuff, and it's, you know, below zero out. It's fun to throw some free to some, you know, just something once in a while for fun, but we use it purely to hold, you know, stack stuff on top of. But we've got a big griddle, which is probably the best thing in there. We make everything on this huge, you know, this is a 24-inch wide, you know, heavy steel griddle that I can do over easy eggs on. I can do all the anything that we cook is probably coming off there. Fried rice, we do pancakes, we do, you know, French toast, everything
yeah.
up there. But the biggest thing is when you're setting up, and, you know, a lot of times when we're setting up our trailer, we're out in the middle of an open field, or, you know, we did a tour of California this year. We did support for the race, and there was a big transfer day where the guys had, I think it was the day that we went into San Jose. Shoot, I'm totally turning around now. But there was the guys had a race, then the race finished in the middle of along the coast, then they had a three-hour drive to get to the hotel to get dinner. So we pulled up the trailer next to the beach, and we made 150 burritos for all the riders out of the trailer. Then we turned around and we drove the 3.5 hours to the finish with everybody else.
Wow.
So the big thing that happens in a lot of situations is having just access to water, and a place to clean and a place to, you know, keep everything. The cooking, that part's easy as long as you got, you know, flame and a pan, but it's the water and the storage and everything else and having fresh, you know, ice and
right.
which we can do all, we have, you know, refrigeration, we have everything we could possibly want in there to do, you know, upwards of 500 meals a day without a problem.
So when you have 500 meals that you're trying to make, are you making these yourself? Do you have help?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's usually, we don't cook those sort of meals on a regular basis.
Okay.
Those, I mean, that volume of meals we do, like this year, the rig was at Sea Otter. So we were set up at Sea Otter. We were doing food all day long out of there. We did a lot more than that, a lot more than 500. And then last year, we were at Cross Nationals in Wisconsin, and then we were in Louisville for some, it was Cross Worlds in Louisville last year. Yeah. So we were there for that. We were in Cincinnati. We pulled the trailer all over the place to where we can set up, and we'll do, you know, easily a couple hundred meals out of there. And whenever we do that, there's me, there's at least two other people, if not three, in the kitchen at any given time. It takes about four people to run it and do any serious volume. There's always one person who's kind of handling all the food, and then everybody else is, you know, interacting with the customers and our friends and stuff at a visit and helping clean and keep the thing moving. But it's usually one person kind of in charge of anything that involves food.
So I'm speaking with Chef Bijou Thomas. He is the author of the original Feed Zone cookbook and now his new book, Feed Zone Portables, which is what we're going to talk about now. So talk about the idea of portable snacks that are so delectable and not necessarily a gel or an energy bar. And I assume that's what this is really all about.
That's exactly what it's about. So when we Feed Zone Portables, the idea itself is born out of, you know, what all of us that grew up riding and racing up until the mid-80s, you know, this is what we ate. And I remember being a junior and going to races and taking frozen burritos because we didn't know any better. And we'd leave it on the dashboard and wait for it to warm up just enough to eat. That was our version of portable food back then. And then somewhere in the mid-80s, the first thing out was Power Bar.
Right, and they were horrible. You know, I'm sorry.
Well, we all saw Power Bar, and we, you know, we were blown away into being like, holy, you know, we didn't know. Like, all of a sudden, he got this really calorie-dense,
sure,
really, you know, portable, convenient food that just totally made sense. Like, wow, this is going to change everything. And we all grew up on that. Then a whole myriad of other products that came along that were really dense calorically and really had, you know, some of them were really good, some of them were questionable, but they all, the intention was still the same, which was to give you the most amount of calories and nutrients you could possibly handle in the least amount of space. But over the years, what we've learned is, even though it sounded like a really good idea on paper, you need a tremendous amount of water to go along with it to be able to process it. First of all, a lot of the products are really dry. And you're looking at 7 to 10% on a moisture level versus stuff that you make at home, which is closer to 70% moisture level.
Sure.
Which is why when you're eating a lot of the packaged foods, you know, you get a couple of bites, you chew it a little bit, and you're like, oh, I need a gallon of water now to get that down. Or I have a really hard time eating. So for the longest time, I just wouldn't eat on rides because I couldn't chew and get it down. So if it's anything less than a two-hour ride, I would go and not eat anything. So the principle on portables was to go back to a lot of the food that the racers grew up with, you know, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And it was all just little sandwiches, little rolls, little pastries, little cakes that you could, you know, cut up into small chunks, take one or two bites, and you got it down, and that was it. You just kept going. You know, when you're in the middle of exercise, what you primarily need is carbohydrates. You don't really need a lot of the other components that are squeezed into a lot of the foods. So we just focused on that and tried to come up with the best-tasting food we could devise.
And so I would agree with that. I mean, I have trouble eating when I ride, too. I have to eat very lightly before I ride and just a little bit during the ride. But taste has always been, I think, what people do object to with some of the commercial products right now. And so as I page through your book, and I got to tell you, there's some really cool things in here, like the way you make cakes and the way you make French toast little bites.
Oh, thank you.
I'm just blown away by the creativity and the simplicity. It just looks easy to do. So you suggest that your recipes are good during exercise. So nutritionally, what is good during exercise as opposed to maybe perhaps before and after? What are you actually taking on the bike or suggesting people run and, you know, they're doing a long distance ride? What can they take with them? Which of your ideas?
I'll touch on a couple of things on that. One is Alan has an anecdote that he shares a lot, which is, you know, you think of all the people sitting at home. You know, if you're just hanging out at home for a day and you're just resting, not doing a lot of exercise, you're watching TV, you're reading books, hanging out with the family, you would not be sitting around eating gels and bars and, you know, that sort of blocks and whatnot throughout the day and drinking energy drink. So because it just wouldn't feel right, right? If you're sitting around the house and eating that. So why then when your body is under stress and under load, would you feel like that would feel any better? That's kind of where we start. Like, okay, so if you wouldn't do it when there is no stress on your body, why would you do it when there is stress on your body? It just doesn't even make any rational sense. It's not like your body's doing anything different. It just, you know. So what our take on the food was, the food first and foremost, food has to taste really good. So if it doesn't, I mean, there's no upside to it. It's not like you're punishing yourself, and therefore, you know, if you go lean, you're going to get better results.
Right.
It just doesn't work. I mean, when a lot of the riders I work with, you know, a lot of the athletes I work with, and you know, we work outside of cycling too. I mean, I work with runners and triathletes and car racers and, you know, climbers. And I work with guys across a full spectrum. Everything comes down to the food has to taste good. If it doesn't taste good, they're not going to eat it. If they don't eat it, the performance is going to suffer. So first and foremost, the food needs to taste as good or better than food you normally eat during the normal course of your day. Because at some point it turns into, how can we trick, it's like trying to feed your toddler. How can I trick my toddler into eating this asparagus? Oh, I'm going to put peanut butter on it. That's going to make it because he likes peanut butter. So it just turns into whatever it takes to make you eat the food, that's what you got to do.
Okay.
I don't know if I answered your question, but that's what it is.
No, you did. You did, pretty much. That, you know, again, we're right back to it needs to taste good. And then not only are you willing to eat it, you want to eat it. And you do need to eat during certain kinds of high-performance exercise, or you're not going to stay at that performance level. I mean, as you say, we're not robots.
I think, you know, there's a kind of a prevailing theory with a lot of products, whether it's beverages, hydration products, or food, and stuff that's out there, and especially stuff that comes that was obviously devised in labs by very smart scientists and people with volumes and volumes of research to back up the science, everything tastes like science. And, you know, we're still dealing with human beings and people that have an emotional response to food and have a very physical, you know, response to things that we put into our mouth. So no matter how great the science is, if it doesn't taste like something that is going to make you feel good, you're probably not going to feel good. It's like when you take medicine, you know, we've all had to take really horrible, horrendous, tasting ridiculous medicines, and we hope it works. But then every now and then, your mom, like, mixes in something with a little bit of honey or a little bit of that, and you're like, wow, I feel good already.
Right, exactly.
So some of it is, yes, the science has to be balanced out with what is actually functional and practical and what is actually going to taste good to get in. Just purely because we're human beings and that's how we work.
So can we talk about your two-bite pies?
Yeah.
I went through the book and I'm thinking, two-bite pies. Mm-hmm. I mean, all you sometimes want is a little taste of something, and this sounds really, really good. So you begin with the crust, then what?
Yep. These are portables. The whole idea was, first and foremost, everything is portable, which means you can make it, cut it into small chunks, and they all wrap easily. And then you can take it along for your ride or your run or whatever you're going to do, or send it with your kids to school for the day. And we have a lot of parents who take food ideas out of the Feeds on Portables book, and that's what the kids are taking for lunch.
Cool.
The kids have fun with it because it's like real food, except now you can cut it into little shapes and whatever, and you wrap it up, and it's kind of a little bit more of intrigue to it as well. But, you know, when you're looking at portable food, as an athlete, as somebody who's riding or whatever your activity is, there are certain limitations you're dealing with all the time. If you're riding, you have to be able to get this thing in your back pocket. It's got to stay together. It can't be seeping all over the place and getting, you know, jelly or sugar, whatever, on your clothes and then back under your skin. You have to be able to reach in your pocket. You have to be able to get it out. You have to be able to open it with one hand. And most likely you're biting part of the packaging and opening it with your hand while you're riding.
Okay.
So while you're doing that, the thing can't crumble and fall all over the place. Then my thinking is usually 1, 2, maybe 3 bites, and you need to be completely finished with that one serving. You know, if it's beyond 2, 3, 4 bites, depending on where you're riding in the terrain, that takes a lot of time away from your ability to focus on the road and the riders next to you and the traffic and everything else. So those are the things I'm thinking about, is how to make it mechanically work, you know, the texture, the feel of it, the size, the weight, the shapes, so it's got to hold together, in addition to tasting good. And then in addition to having enough moisture so you can actually get it down in a couple of bites, and then, you know, with just normal sip of water.
Right.
So those are things I'm thinking about. But then in addition to that, going back to my original Feed Zone cookbook and the principles there, the ingredients have to all be common, everyday ingredients that you can find at a normal market. You know, sometimes you're going to be shopping at Whole Foods. Sometimes you're shopping at 7-Eleven. It's whatever you happen to have. And, you know, the ingredients have to be stuff you can find. The ingredients also have to be things that just a normal everyday home cook can understand and deal with. There's no point in writing really cool, far-fetched, you know, complicated things that nobody can redo at home. So working within the confines of all those ideas, you're like, okay, now let's go to work and see what we can come up with. And, you know, at the end of the day, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich might be the best thing you can eat on a ride, because that's what you can actually make. In that case, that's what you should take with you.
So how many calories are in your snacks? Because, you know, when you look at, say, the package of gels, let's just say somebody makes a gel like Goo or like one of those companies, and it's usually about 100 calories, and you're eating like 6 or 7 of these kind of gummy bear gels.
Yes.
Is that how many calories are approximately in one of your servings, so that you're getting sort of an equal amount of energy, you know, producing stuff?
Sure, sure. Yeah, originally the way we were looking at it, if you look at our very first, you know, the rice cakes, we were
right.
just using cooked sticky rice that you would blend with a little bit of sugar, a little bit of salt, and then whatever you like to eat. We put in fresh minced apples, we put in bacon, we put in eggs, soy sauce, you know. The key there is you start with sticky rice, and then whatever you will eat, there's no wrong answer. Jam it in there. Those, the calories, kind of depending, and ultimately kind of depends on how much sugar you add and also how big the portions are. But we were looking about 2 to 3 inch squares, and the servings would be roughly range right around 150 calories or so. And that's what we were going for. We figured if you eat one of these an hour, if you can get more down, great. If not, if you can get one of these down an hour, in addition to what you're drinking, in addition to anything else you're consuming, you know, you're coming around 300 calories or so, which is the total calorie intake with whatever you're drinking, whatever you're eating. So it seems a little bit more balanced. What I have found is if we can keep the squares to roughly 150 calories, that's about the ideal range we want to be with any food items, 150 to 200 or so calories.
Got it.
And that, I mean, it ultimately comes down to personal preference on how big you want to make.
Yeah, sure.
How many you're going to take. And what we find with a lot of the pro riders we work with and the guys who are eating rice cakes, they'll go through about, you know, they'll usually go through about one every 45 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then some of the guys will, you know, eat a couple of them an hour without a problem.
I have to say that there are some very clever ideas in here. And I want to add that there are gluten-free recipes, because I eat gluten-free. I have friends who have celiac who are gluten-free. And your idea to just take a loaf of gluten-free bread and use that as your crust for your pies is such a cool idea. You've thought about all of it. It's really, really cool. Feed Zone.
Yeah, that was, there's like 3 really good ideas in this book that should, for a normal cook at home, be like, oh my God, why didn't I think of that? And that's one of them. where, you know, if you ever tried to cook gluten-free and as a regular home cook, and if you're particularly, if you're a younger, you know, person starting off in a career of trying to be an athlete or being a student, or you're away from home for the first time, you're trying to eat a lower gluten diet, you could go spend $150 on different ingredients.
Right.
Come home, before you've had a single muffin, you're out $150. And then the first couple of times you make anything, it's probably going to not be that great.
No, probably not.
You know, the first few times you make it, it's really dense, it's really heavy, it's really, the flavors are off, the texture's off. So, which is very discouraging. So a lot of people will make it once or twice, and then they'll probably never make it again, and you just wasted a bunch of money and time. So my thought was, there's got to be a way. And, there's, you know, some of the food in here, sure, there's ways you can dress it up and make it a lot better than the basic recipes I've given. But then the thought was, there's got to be a way to make gluten-free cookies, gluten-free pastries, gluten-free pancakes, waffles, all with just maybe one new ingredient. And that's essentially what we did. And one of those was using the gluten-free bread as a major component. You'll have to get the book to get the actual recipe, but it really is pretty awesome once you make it. And I use that gluten-free bread recipe for, there's a banana, I call it a banana pie in there because I stuffed it, but you can also turn that same recipe into banana cake or banana pancakes or whatever. It is so good. If you didn't tell people it was gluten-free, they would never even know it.
Good gluten-free food does not taste funny. I can tell you that for sure. That is
true. I mean, it can have nice springy texture and flavor, and it can be all that.
Right.
And the beauty of going with some of the gluten-free recipes are you get a lot more protein, you get a, you know, you get a lot more other nutrients other than just what you're getting from, you know, wheat flour when you're going with standard recipes. I don't think you have to eat gluten-free just because you want to. You can also eat it because it tastes better and it makes you feel better afterwards.
We have about a minute left. Can you talk to me about Eisdot in a minute?
Yeah, Eisdot, that's the helmet sensor company that I helped start a couple of years ago with a couple of my friends, including Lucas Huser, and Eisdot, the company out of Tulsa. They just launched the product to the public last week at the Tulsa Tough Race. The sensor itself, it clips onto your helmet, and if you get into an accident, you knock your head, it triggers your phone to basically call for help, gives people on your emergency list your location on a map, and it opens up a screen with all your emergency info. So if somebody finds you, they open up your phone, all your information's right there.
Wow.
They don't have to dig through and punch in numbers. It's all right there, and it's all automated. It's all done for you. And, yeah, we're super excited to be bringing that out to the world, and it's launching globally as we speak. We're hoping to see some teams and riders with it over the next few weeks or at some of the bigger races.
So besides having your little fingers in all that food, you have your fingers in Eisdot, which is very, very cool. And we'll put a link up to Eisdot, Feed Zone Portables, Bijou Thomas and Ellen Lim. It's an excellent addition to your cookbook shelf if you do not have it. Bijou, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. Now you can go back to testing all that food.
Great. Thank you, Dad. Have a great afternoon.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Chef
Bijou Thomas joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. I guess I found one of the few times he's actually been home all year. I appreciate that he was able to talk with me. He had a lot of interesting things to say. I'm hoping to try some of his recipes in the next few weeks. Well, that's it for the show. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, there's always a conversation going on our Facebook page. Join in if you have something to say. Start a new conversation if you'd like. I'll be back next Saturday with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Meantime, enjoy your week. Go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.